This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
This podcast may contain explicit language, and feel free to use explicit language when you review the gist on iTunes. It helps other people find the show. It's Friday, May 24th, 2019. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Theresa May has been auto-defenestrated, and though her voice caught as she made her announcement, her policies never caught on. It was a sad result on a personal level. It was inevitable on a practical level. And let's face it, it was a failure on a national level. Brexit, the unworkable charge, the unmanageable problem, felled her. But she, in choosing to administer to the will of the voters, actually failed the voters. She was honest throughout her speech. I believe her when she says,
"It is and will always remain a matter of deep regret to me that I have not been able to deliver Brexit. It will be for my successor to seek a way forward that honours the result of the referendum. To succeed, he or she will have to find consensus in Parliament where I have not."
Good luck with that. She might believe that, but Parliament and much of the public do not. Then there was this.
"Never forget that compromise is not a dirty word. Life depends on compromise."
Again, that's a little bit of hope over experience. Now, I do want to mend a little bit something I said. I called her honest. I don't think she's lying, but I do take issue with this. The very first thing out of her mouth as she announced that she was stepping down.
"Ever since I first stepped through the door behind me as Prime Minister, I have striven to make the United Kingdom a country that works not just for a privileged few, but for everyone, and to honour the result of the EU referendum."
Good use of striven, but here's the problem. The second bit, "and to honor the result of the EU referendum," totally overwhelmed and indeed prevented the first. Brexit so dominated policy, energy, and attention that nothing else was possible. A UN rapporteur concluded that Brexit, and more pointedly, the austerity policies championed by May's Tory party, have needlessly decimated the UK. Quote, "tragic social consequences," the rapporteur called it. And I guess not having to listen to rapporteurs is why one would vote to get out of the EU. But these tragic social consequences did stem from the discredited policies of austerity and the ignorant fear of helping people who are unlike us, the tribalist us versus them cloistering that was attendant to the Brexit vote and the Brexit spirit. Brexit, austerity, fear, hatred of the other, these are all cousins. And the Brexit obsession and the consequences of trying to pursue Brexit will fuel the following, as the report details. Quote, "relative child poverty rates are expected to increase by 7% between 2015 and 2021, and overall child poverty rates to reach close to 40%. For almost one in every two children to be poor in 21st century Britain would not just be a disgrace, but a social calamity and an economic disaster rolled into one." Continuing, "the bottom line is that much of the glue that has held British society together since the Second World War has been deliberately removed and replaced with a harsh and uncaring ethos." So how much is Brexit to blame? I'll let the report define that. This is a document that is not excessively long, but it does have 10 sections and lots of footnotes and subsections. I will now read you one of the 10 sections was on Brexit. I will now read you all of its entry on Brexit. "If Brexit proceeds, it is likely to have a major adverse impact on the most vulnerable." And that's it. And even though it hasn't proceeded, the evidence is clear that the adverse impact is already being felt. On the show today, I talk about my plan to read history, having already read history. But first, a podcast that I just got finished with. It is a limited documentary series. It is the third entry into the headlong series. It is called Running from Cops. The cops in question are questionable. They are the cops on the TV show Cops, that repository of shirtlessness, mayhem, and, as we will soon find out, dishonesty from all involved. Dan Taberski of Running from Cops up next. Hey, listener, you may have heard via your earbuds, car stereo, smart speaker, or immersive shower sound system that podcasts are the future. We at Slate think so, too, which is why we are hosting Slate Day in New York City on Saturday, June 8th. And it won't just be stuffy panels. Oh, but it'll be them, too. The day starts with a performance by Ms. Cracker of RuPaul's Drag Race fame. We've got pop culture trivia, where you can join Slate's own writers. A play date for kids organized by our parenting podcast, Mom and Dad Are Fighting, and you know Hit Parade, that podcast about the biggest hits in pop and music. They are going to have a dance party. Of course, we will have panels too, including mine, titled The Art of Podcasting with Mike Pesca. I'll be asking questions to the people who usually ask questions in this, the podcast industry. I can't wait for it. Go to slate.com/live for tickets. See you Saturday, June 8th.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends, so for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcasts, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Headlong is the documentary series from Pineapple Street Media. You might not know the branding of Headlong, but I bet you know the three documentary series that have come out under that label. The first was Missing Richard Simmons. The second was about Y2K. And the third is Running from Cops. Dan Taberski is the host and the reporter behind all of these. And of course, cops, as they say, what you going to do when they come for you? Well, Taberski came for them, and you may never look at cops the same way. Hello, Dan. Thanks
for
coming in.
How are you? Thanks for having me.
So as you explain on episode one, you always love the show. A lot of people do. But there was something there before you probably even had the documentary series where you must have said to yourself, what is really going on here with this show?
Yeah, I've watched Cops for years and years. I grew up watching TV as wallpaper, like background noise, you know? And so Cops is perfect because it's literally on 15 times a day.
Yeah.
And I've always, you know, I mean, reality shows are like Housewives and Duck Hunters, and just everyone knows what reality shows are. But there was something about that show that I do find compelling.
Right.
They point cameras at communities that don't get cameras pointed at them very often. You see different types of interactions than you would on a normal show. It's pretty straight up real seeming. There's no music. There's no narration. It's just sort of verite style. I like all that. I've always known that they were, you know, on the
flip side. We all do. I mean, look at their success.
Super compelling. But on the flip side, you always sort of wonder, what's going on here? Like, how does this work? How are the police participating in this?
How long have you wanted to crack the code of cops?
It's always been on my list.
Yeah.
It's always been on my list, but not really knowing how to do it. I've always thought it might be a documentary, but that gets complicated because then you're showing visuals of a show that you don't have the rights to, and it's quite complicated. The podcast made much more sense. You can go in and report it. It's all fair use. It's all, you're criticizing the show, so you're not worried about, you're also not worried about re-exploiting the people on the show by showing the video again.
So the number one question with Cops that is asked by anyone who knows somewhat how this stuff goes down is, how do they get these people to sign the waiver? Because if their faces aren't pixelated, they allowed the cops or the show cops to have the rights, and it would seem to be an illogical move for most of them. When I worked for On the Media, Bob Garfield did a story on that. We interviewed John Langley, is the guy who invented cops, and he has answers, which are things like, oh, they don't know, they don't care, it's not so bad for them. You found out that this is largely a self-serving set of answers.
Yeah, I mean, his answer has always been that people want to be reality show famous. Doesn't even matter if it's cops, they just want to be on TV. And I've always found that suspicious. But how do you prove him wrong? By the only way to do it is to talk to people who've been on the show. Those people are really hard to find. We spent months looking. We found 9 people who've been on the show. Of those 9, only one signed willingly. Everybody else either did not sign a release, they were too drunk or high to know that what they were doing, or they were coerced into it by police and producers working together and doing things like threatening suspects with trumped up charges if they don't sign. Doing things like, you know, there was one lawsuit saying they handcuffed a guy to a bench for 2 to 3 hours until he would sign.
So the whole thing that you document is that it's not a documentary crew following around cops. These are cops and documentarians who have intertwined, whose DNA is mixed, and who are the last people who are able to really be able to sort out who is who. It's these people who are, you know, in extremis and just have been arrested. So the cops are frequently essentially using their power to get the TV crew to get their signatures.
That's how it seems.
Or
like
just
to me.
Faking it also. Like sometimes the signatures aren't even got, right?
From the people we found, there were several instances of people saying they just flat up didn't sign.
Yeah.
And they just entered it anyway.
Yeah.
And it makes sense. There's a logic to it. These people are really powerless people. They don't have money. They don't have resources. They don't have
connections. You couldn't find them. I mean, you found 8 and it's been on the air 30 years. Yeah. And you found 8 or 9 people.
Yeah. And that was really hard to do.
It does seem like they get their man and they put him into, or woman, and they inject them into the criminal justice system. Is that normally how things actually go?
What do you mean?
Well, they make an arrest and the disclaimer says innocent until proven guilty, but we're left to believe that justice will be meted out. But I think you found a bunch of instances where the arrest didn't stick. The interaction that seemed like it was law-breaking wasn't law-breaking.
Yeah, I mean, just straight up, like, of course, in the beginning of every episode, the announcer says, all suspects are innocent until proven guilty.
And he says it like a game show announcer.
Totally. Yeah. And like, but nobody believes that when you're watching that show. The entire show is edited to point toward guilt. But what we found one case where it was a super simple, cut and dry, cocaine bust, 2 kids in a church parking lot, cop pulls up, can I search your car? Yes, you can. They find cocaine, does a nick test on the roadside drug test. It's cocaine, sends them to prison. Turns out those nick tests are notoriously ineffective, that often they give up wrong results. And we found that these people, it was not cocaine in their car. The state test proved that it wasn't. We then found the raw footage of that segment, which led to revelation. So that segment was a 7-minute segment on the show Cops. What it actually was shot was 97 minutes of raw video, and we watched that video. And by watching that video, I don't want to say too much about it, but they don't tell a shorter story. They don't tell a simpler story. They tell a completely different story than what actually happened in that police interaction.
Who has final cut on this footage? Contractually,
the police have final cut on all episodes of Cops. They get to look at the rough cuts and say, yes, you can put that in there. No, you can't put in there. You know you can't put that in there. And which, you know, they don't tell the viewer, and which completely changes the name of the game, right? It completely changes what you're looking at. The police are in control of the message that they're putting out on this Cops, on this show, and it's been like that since 1989.
So I find in general with reality shows and the people who watch them, at least most of the people who I know will say something like, look, I know it's cooked to some extent. The viewer doesn't want to seem like a rube himself or herself.
Sure.
So they tell themselves something like, I know there's a fair amount of artifice and there's selective editing done, but usually from what I know of how the reality shows are made, they go much further than we would ever imagine. I guess my question is, what do you think psychologically that thing that we tell ourselves is doing? Without that, would Cops really be successful? If the viewers weren't able to have some almost plausible deniability in their part of the process?
I think that people expect a lot of artifice in reality shows. But this isn't about housewives. This isn't about duck hunters. This is about something real. And I do think that a viewer looks at this show, and yes, they suspect that the police are being made to look better than they are at their jobs. They suspect that the bad guys are being made to look dumber or stupider or more evil than they really are. But on the whole, I think they assume that what they're seeing is, in general, a reflection of what really happened. And after 18 months of looking into the show, I don't even think you can assume that anymore.
Yeah, I think most people say, look, not everyone who a cop rolls up on is guilty, and they will just take the ones who are most extreme or the meth heads who seem funniest. Mm-hmm. But you're saying, question even that. Question pretty much everything that you see on Cops, and also know that it's not guys who are part of a camera crew who are documenting police. It's police and a camera crew operating side by side in ways that, if we really knew about it, would give us pause, or should give us pause.
Correct. Absolutely. I mean, it looks like it looks fly in the wall, right?
Yeah.
When you see the show, it looks like the
Do you think the Verite style helps give it more credibility?
Oh my gosh, yeah. For sure. It did for me. I mean, it makes it more watchable. You don't feel like you're being fed a message, a line. It just seems real.
Right.
Until you realize all the tiny little non-truths that go into putting together that reflection of reality, and when you add all those things up, that the police are in charge of the message, that the people who are on the show are not agreeing to be on the show, that they consistently portray bad policing as good policing over and over and over for 30 years, that when we see the raw video of these segments, that they're not editing these segments to show what really happened. When you put all those things together, yeah, the cinema verite style, it's a bit of a joke.
It seems insane that we're in this moment of legitimate questioning of police practices, and Cops is just skating by. There's a backlash for everything these days. Where's Cops' backlash?
I don't know. I don't know that it needs a backlash. I just think people need to ask more questions. I also think what happens with a show like Cops is that people don't talk about culture unless it's good,
mm-hmm.
unless it's new.
Yeah.
So the minute something is on, everyone's already talked about it, then it just goes. And it sort of recedes into that, gets a million views for new episodes. It's on 15, 20 times a day. It's on its syndication. They're making their money. Nobody's really paying attention. And it can just go and go and go. And so I think it's hard to sort of resurrect these things and re-ask those questions unless you make a concerted effort to do it.
Do you think that the sheer volume of Cops gives it cover in some way? Because this is what I'm thinking. If there was one documentary that had some of the abuses that you uncovered, and then you came along and uncovered them, I don't know, there'd be a call to withdraw that documentary. Those documentarians would feel like outcasts in their society.
Yeah.
Just Cops has existed doing these things, and I think you documented them most thoroughly, but there have been other instances,
sure,
when it has at least been known locally that these were bad busts or what you saw wasn't true.
Yeah.
They seem to have skated by with no accountability.
Yeah. I don't know what that is, honestly. I think people have a lot to worry about now.
Yeah.
And it's hard to raise people's attention to be concerned about certain things. I also think it's quite diffuse. It's not like the feds are participating in the show. It's 150 different police departments around the country. People don't really know what's happening.
Right.
And these police departments—
And they're not huge cities.
No. They tend to be smaller cities. Spokane, Washington, for example. Spokane, Washington, Portland, Oregon. And the police departments sign up for this. The people who live there don't really know what's happening. The only people who end up know what's happening are Cops fans and the people who end up on these shows.
Do you think, when you went into this, did you think you'd find some interesting, curious things, or did you have every intention of this being essentially expose-style journalism?
No, I did not. I went in, I have to say, I went in super open, which is how I tend to do these things. Like,
yeah.
Because I'm not talking to the devil. I'm talking to TV
right.
producers. I'm talking to police officers, people who have really hard jobs. I'm talking to suspects. Like, I don't
think your first two series had an antagonist, for instance.
No.
Yeah.
I don't know. And I went in trying to understand it because it's not a joke. I think before the podcast even started, I estimate I've seen about 500 episodes of Cops. That I am implicated. And so it was more a curiosity about to really understand what they've been showing me for so long and how much am I buying in hook, line, and sinker.
Is there anyone in law enforcement who said this is bad thing for us on our profession?
For sure.
Yeah,
for sure. I mean, I don't think the show like Cops necessarily serves the police either. Policing is a hard, hard, complicated job, and it makes it seem super
simple. Yeah, you're
just
busting stupid meth heads.
Yeah, yeah, it makes it seem futile. And it also supports a type of policing that a lot of these officers don't want to be participating in. Officers, for the most part, you know, the job is to make sure that people are following the laws, not make them, not make policy. It's to execute the policy and make sure that it's being followed. And to maintain a system and to maintain a show that doesn't ask questions about that system, it doesn't help the people who are doing it to make their jobs any easier.
Dan Taberski is the host of Running From Cops, which is season 3 of the Headlong podcast from Pineapple Street Media. Thanks for coming in, Dan.
Oh, you're kidding. My pleasure.
And now the spiel. I think I'm going to read or delve into, which means read via audiobook, some history this Memorial Day weekend. There will be reading. There will be woods. I am guessing there will be a hike. I do not want there to be a hike. The very name hike is pejorative. Oh, you want to go to Sagrady's? Oh, man, that's a hike. Oh, so let's name our leisure activity after this. Then again, a day at the beach is no picnic, as they say. But I will read history. I was so taken by this book I just read that I talked about yesterday, The Impeachers, about Andrew Johnson. I just downloaded a New Deal book, thus answering the age-old question, what's the deal with the New Deal? There's a downside to delving into history. It's frustrating. I feel like Charlton Heston in Planet of the Apes, all shirtless and having crash-landed from a French sci-fi novel. Well, not that part, actually. But often when I read history, this feeling comes over me.
You maniacs! You blew it up! Oh, damn you! God damn you all to hell!
It's just the sense that we never learn. Or we learn, I mean, someone learns, it's right there in this book that I'm reading, but we, societally, do not apply the lessons. But there is a consoling thought, at least to me, and remember who I am. I am an angry human pounding sand who thinks he traveled through space but actually traveled through time, which is this. It is true that those who don't learn history are doomed to repeat it. Santa Anna said that right before he killed Davy Crockett. I know that because I learned history. What? Santa Anna? Not Santa Anna? Anyway, the part about Santa Anna's statement that isn't true isn't the doomed to repeat it part. It's the if you don't learn history. Because there is no real learning of history in that history keeps changing. The most feckless character in the impeachment of Andrew Johnson, other than Andrew Johnson, is Edmund Ross, senator from Kansas, who was the last vote to acquit. Ross was pretty much forgotten to history until the cowardly senator was remembered in Profiles in Courage, John F. Kennedy's biography of supposedly brave senators. He stood up, as Kennedy wrote, for Andrew Johnson, and here is how he described the tension between him and the Republicans. Johnson was determined to carry out Abraham Lincoln's policies of reconciliation with the defeated South, whereas the more radical Republican leaders of Congress, quote, sought to administer the downtrodden Southern states as conquered provinces, which had forfeited their rights under the Constitution. This reading of history is 180 degrees wrong. 180 degrees wrong. We know now that it was the radical Republicans who were trying to save the country, the so-called radical Republicans, by preserving the Union, by defining citizenship for the former slaves, and by making their citizenship real. By the way, this whole book, Profiles in Courage, wasn't even written by Kennedy. It was written by essentially his ghostwriter, Ted Sorensen. So if you're playing at home, we have a Pulitzer Prize winning historical work by a political leader profiling the courage of other political leaders. Turns out it was actually written by someone who wasn't that political leader, and it was written about so-called courageous leaders who weren't actually courageous or leaders. The reason I bought, which is to say downloaded with membership, this New Deal book was that I was listening to an interview with the architect of the Green New Deal who recommended this book. The Green New Deal is implicitly and often explicitly invoking that gray old deal, the general theory being it was a giant societal lift that the government undertook
as it positively transformed the lives of millions. I would say the lives of most Americans. True. But think about the biggest problems that we have today. I will list three of the big problems. Healthcare, housing, the primacy of the automobile. Automobiles, by the way, being the biggest single emitters of greenhouse gases. All of these problems were born or exacerbated, not alleviated, by policies that were part of or adjacent to the Green New Deal. Healthcare is the obvious one. In 1942, FDR signed Executive Order 9050. As the U.S. was emerging from the Depression, the government intended to freeze wages because it knew that inflation would go crazy otherwise. And it worked. Inflation was corralled. But businesses, now realizing they couldn't give people higher salaries, had to figure out a new way to induce people to work for them. And it was healthcare. Employer-provided healthcare. Soon thereafter, the IRS, and no one knows exactly who, decides that healthcare shouldn't be taxed. It's a sensible decision at the time. And from this quirk of history is born our odd, our weird, and we have to admit our highly dysfunctional healthcare system. Thanks, FDR. Then you got housing. This one is directly a part, literally a part of the New Deal. In 1934, the National Housing Act, the goal of home ownership is entrenched in law, mortgages become easier to get. Add to this the Housing Act of 1937, and we have established a route to wealth generations, the route to wealth generations for generations, not of white people, mostly, that you own a home, you build wealth that way. It did solve a problem. It surely did, but it also created one. Now we have a system where if fewer people owned homes, and if homes weren't the major, the overwhelming way that people saved money, we'd be better off. A system more like Europe is better off. We'd be able to meet our housing needs more easily, and we'd also have a better safety net for individual savers. The last is cars, Federal Highway Act of 1938. I read from a Washington Post article at the time. Proposals for a new form of empire building, a network of superhighways, have been seriously considered by President Roosevelt in connection with his $4,888 million works program, it was reported yesterday. So it is true. Eisenhower built the federal highway system, but Roosevelt poured the conceptual asphalt as part of the New Deal. So employer health care, houses as a means of wealth, embracing cars. These were all not just good ideas at the time, but they were necessary ideas. They absolutely fueled Americans' growth. They absolutely fueled American growth. They made us better off as people. But as with all gains, there are often costs. The supremacy of the automobile as the backbone of transit has environmental, economic, and practical costs. The housing situation in America is not a healthy one. The health situation in America isn't a healthy one. So what I've been doing is I've been thinking about this. Does this mean that we shouldn't have created the solutions we did back then? What does this say about the solutions we're striving for now? Should we have done something different? How could we have known this? Would we be better off if we hadn't solved those problems? And we did solve those problems in the way we solved those problems. Should Pandora's box just have been left unopened? See, I don't believe so. I believe that the benefits far, far outweigh the costs. Might seem weird for me to say that because we're told that the costs have been so high. We're told we're at a critical inflection point from which we may never recover. We're told that this is a challenge for the ages, a challenge like we've never faced. We're told that our current system is intractable. Could it be that we'd be better off if we never built those roads or provided those mortgages or granted that health coverage? I think a few things are happening. One is that it is true that systems are more complicated. They're more Byzantine. Plus, when we talk about the age of the New Deal, there's 130 million Americans. Now there's 330 million Americans. And we're all aware of all the problems in the world, thanks to media and thanks to education. Thanks, education. Maybe we've become less hardy as people. You hear this all the time. I don't really think so. I think it's a natural consequence of human nature. So let's say you live amidst weeds, a field of weeds, 100 acres of weeds. So what do? You go out and you clear it. You clear and kill all those weeds. And then you live weed-free for a while. And your kids grow up in this weed-free world. But then new strains of weeds pop up. Maybe they're the ones who are prevented from the earlier weeds. Maybe they're
actually more virulent strains. But your children have lived in this weed-free world for years and years and years. So now they look at the weed situation and they've never had anything to compare it to. They can't believe it. They never knew a time of weeds. And by the way, if when the weeds come back, they only come back on 50 of your 100 acres or 30, it is infinitely more daunting to the weedless than anything they've ever seen before. Maybe a different analogy is something like this. You're drowning, so you swim, and you swim furiously. And you don't drown, you live. But the expense of all that swimming is that you expend energy, and this causes your body temperature to fall. And if you stay out at sea, you won't survive. You do what you need to survive, it has a consequence. And now you're in a situation where if something doesn't change, you won't survive. Were you better off having drowned? You were not. Was swimming the best strategy? I would say it was. I don't know. Maybe some expert could have come up with a way that if you had swum better or smarter, you'd actually be better off today. But you didn't. You didn't do it perfectly. You were just trying to live. But the thing is, and you have to realize that at least you did swim and you didn't sink. And what you did was you bought yourself some time. Maybe you'll latch on to some driftwood, and that will be a temporary solution. Maybe a boat will come by and just pluck you out of the water. Or maybe you'll be able to hang on long enough and not give up, and you'll spot land on the horizon, which could be reachable with your one final burst of energy. So it all could have been worth it. If it were me, I would swim for sure. I would not look back. Of course, I have to admit, I have waterproof headphones, good for listening to histories, as I stave off eels and hypothermia and wondered why I ever agreed to jump in that lake on Memorial Day in the woods without correctly measuring how far out I went. And that's it for today's show. Pierre Bien-Aimé and Daniel Schrader produced The Gist. They started out running from cops on a daily show. Running from cops, there they met. Running from cops, TJ Raphael. Running from cops, senior producer. Running from cops, of all the Slate shows. Running from cops, she's been read her rights. Running from cops, and now she knows. Running from cops. Oh, she's running from cops. This is the gist. You know it's true. Running from cops. Peru. Running from cops. And Peru to Peru. You're running from cops. I know you like that. Thanks for listening.